Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
What we've done at RMA is to, in the last year, host numerous stakeholder meetings.
Marcia Bunger, Administrator, USDA's Risk Management Agency.
We've hosted what we call the RMA Roadshow, where we've gone out both in virtual presence and in in-person presence and hosted a number of training educational opportunities for the whole farm program and also for microfarm. In the last year, we've taken the steps to reduce red tape with the paperwork with whole farm and microfarm. We've doubled the amount of revenue limits on whole farm. We've tripled that for microfarm so that now even more small beginning farmers have the opportunity to use that microfarm policy.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, we have a great veteran staff on both the House and Senate side for House and Senate Ag, and they're always great to work with, and we appreciate their support.
Allison Rivera is Executive Director, Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You do have a lot of new members of Congress and a lot of new staff coming in with them. Sometimes veteran staff will move offices and end up with a new member. I myself did that a few times. Sometimes you see staffers come in that maybe didn't come from agriculture. I myself was that staffer back in the day. The really important thing is when we have our legislative fly-in, and lots of groups will do that and have their members come into D.C. and go to the Hill and lobby on these issues. It's so important because they're going to be talking to staffers that are truly trying to gather the appropriate information so that they can adequately staff their bosses and get them all the information. And particularly with this farm bill, you know, what's everyone asking for? What's that commodity group asking for versus another? It's going to be a lot of educating, and that's what we're here to do.
She's been watching transportation issues at the federal level closely.
I will start with the positive piece. So we still have electronic logging device delay for livestock haulers until September 30th of 2023. We got that passed through the end of year omnibus package. We did lose our hours of service, a complete exemption due to COVID-19 because the quote unquote emergency was over, according to President Biden. So we did lose that, but we had that for over 2.5 years, and that's very significant. And I will remind people that we also still have that back end 150 air mile exemption for livestock haulers that adds about 2.5 to 3 hours extra time of driving, and I think has been a huge help for our haulers. You know, as we look towards this new Congress, again, we're going to be doing a lot of educating in the livestock hauling space. Less than 1% of the trucks on the road. You can't paint the entire trucking industry with one brush because we are just so diverse, and it's just very different. It's very different hauling toilet paper versus live haul. And so we're going to get into those offices and you know, start giving that message. You know, we're trying to find flexibility under hours of service for livestock haulers. Why not just exempt us? We've been able to be safe in the last 2.5 years with a full exemption. We can continue it with a more permanent exemption.
Transportation regulations just part of the problem. Then you have labor issues as well.
You know, we still have ag labor needs across industries, and particularly in trucking. I mean, someone alluded to the fact that, you know, why would a driver do live haul, long and live, when he can maybe drive for Amazon and be home each night? And that, you know, those are good factors. You know, there's good points to make. You know, you have to look at, you know, raising wages if you have to. There's a lot of factors to look at, right? And we know that our livestock haulers are out there doing an amazing job every day, and they're so needed. But again, you know, you're going to have guys that retire. How do we maintain these drivers and make sure that we don't have a shortage? We do have a shortage currently. So what do we need to do to figure out how to keep these drivers in the truck? And so I think that's going to be kind of an ongoing conversation. But in my mind, one of the ways to do that is to lessen some of these regulations on them. And we continue to talk about that. Make it, you know, they're out there driving safely. You know, let's make the system work for them so that we can keep them driving.
And where can you find out what NCBA is working on?
NCBA.org. We're happy to share our policies on that website. You know, we're very open about the policies that we're working on in D.C., and you can take a look at our Farm Bill priorities on there as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So we talk about leverage.
Kevin Good is with Cattle Facts.
We've got retail prices this year going up 1% after 3 years where you had an 8% annual increase. Last year we had record large production. Retailer had the advantage over the packer as far as that transaction. And so last year, the percentage of that retail value that's moving back to wholesale was very small. Now we're going to transition into tighter supplies. Therefore, the packing community will have more leverage over the retailer, and we're suggesting more of those retail dollars will trickle back down to wholesale. And so we had retail up 1%. We're suggesting that wholesale will be up 4% for this year and resuming that longer-term uptrend that's been at 4.2% for quite some time. Wholesale had to pull back this past year. We got a little bit too stout as you go back and think about 2021. We would suggest as we move forward, and it's already starting to appear with these tighter supplies, the floor is being raised in the carcass cutout. You can see our annual average forecast is basically for a 270, which would suggest that 250 plus or minus the bottom side and something approaching 3 at the top side would be our forecast for the year. From a relationship between wholesale, the cutout, and fed cattle values, you can see that last year was a tremendous change from 20 to 21. To give you an illustration there, that's a 10-point move. A 10-point move, that's almost $400 a head. And you think about fed values, we were up $20 plus 100 weight. Despite the fact that wholesale was lower last year than the year prior, it's leverage. Leverage improved tremendously last year. We're suggesting it will continue to improve again this year and really over the next couple years. You can see the math that we've done in there. Our forecast for this year is going to be a 158 fed market with a 270 cutout and a $15 drop. If we're at 158 for an annual average, and we're starting the year in the mid-50s, what does it look like from a seasonal standpoint? We are in a non-expansion seasonal. In other words, we've been liquidating. So in theory, over time, we're going into tighter supplies and should trend into higher prices, all other things being equal. If that's the case, your highs should occur again late year like they've done the last couple of years. We're suggesting here from our base in the mid-150s that we push into the mid-160s for a summer high. We would have the risk of coming back between 150 and 155 for a summer low and finishing the year somewhere close to 170 to get to 158 average. That's the way we would lay out the fed market. If that's the case, looking at the feeder market, we're suggesting in here that we move another notch higher compared to where we were last year and end up averaging somewhere closer to 195. That might sound like a reach from where we're at today and where we've been, but think about where the deferred futures are at. If you go from the D's of this year on into the Feb and April of next year, we're already in the mid to upper 160s, pushing 170 in April of 24. Mike talked about corn prices moving lower through the second half of the year. You do the math there, it's easy to get a yearling market this fall at 210, 215. Very easy doing the math there. On the calf market this year, we've got it between 2 and 250 with the 2.25 average. Obviously, headwinds that we have and continue to face are input costs. The value of our calves as we go through this year and forward are going to be higher. We recognize that we're going to have economic incentives to expand the herd. It's not only just feed, it's higher values as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We had record-level beef production in 2022, but we built that record production on the backs of liquidation, right? So it's not a sustainable thing.
Dr. Darrell Peel, Oklahoma State livestock economist.
So we know that beef production is going to fall starting in 2023, probably for the next 2 or 3 years at least. So things like cow slaughter, which have been elevated the last 2 years, are going to drop sharply, with implications for the ground beef market in particular. So, you know, we're probably going to see, we're going to have less beef. That's going to imply some rationing of beef in the domestic market through higher prices, more than likely. It implies likely that we're going to import some more beef, in particular that processing beef, because I think that supply is going to be really impacted as we cut cow culling at some point when we do try to stop liquidating. And we'll probably see exports back off a little bit from the record levels we had in 2022. We just got that data to confirm that we did set a new record in 2022. But, you know, going forward, A, we're not going to have as much beef. B, it's probably going to be more expensive. And, you know, the strength of the dollar in an exchange rate sense has been a headwind a little bit, although that has backed off a little bit. So we have to wait and see how that goes. But for all of those reasons, we're going to see some differences in these trade flows that will help supplement the market here in one way or another.
It's one thing to believe that slaughter numbers have been strong, but what do the numbers say?
You know, the last several years, we talked earlier about this balance between slaughter capacity and how that adjusted over about a 20-year period to get down to a level. Then the last herd expansion going up to the peaks in 2019 sort of tapped that balance and really put us in a situation. Then things like the pandemic with the labor issues that and the constraints that provided meant that we really did face a very binding bottleneck, if you will, in the industry. And so, you know, we've been watching that, and the labor problems in particular in the packing industry have been particularly acute the last few years. And so the numbers that you're referring to in 2022, 18 times we saw daily fed cattle slaughter exceed 100,000 head. And that had not happened since 2013. So over that time, we've been close. We're up there 98, 99, 99 and a half, but we had not been over 100,000. And if you go prior to 2013, we did it quite a lot. A lot of years, you know, 30 to 50 times. But it hadn't happened since then. So first one happened in either May or June of 2022. And then by the end of the year, we were hitting them, you know, semi-regularly, 100,000 head. So what that means is that we probably don't have the kinds of labor issues in the packing plant. We haven't changed the overall capacity much, maybe some small plants, but the mainstream capacity is the same. But we're using it more effectively now because we don't have the labor constraints. And so, you know, and of course, with numbers getting tighter now, as we go forward, we obviously have plenty of capacity for the number of cattle that we're going to be able to produce here for the next 3 to 5 years at least.
So if you thought 21 and 22 were a wild ride, what's ahead for 23?
I think you need to fasten your seat belts. It may be a little bumpy. It will no doubt be exhilarating at times and maybe downright frightening at times. But, you know, it's the nature of this industry. We've been through some things kind of like it before. There'll be some differences this time. You know, it's just the nature of this industry. We will get things done. We will get back to where we need to be. I have no doubt the industry will rebuild from the liquidation that's been forced on us by the drought. But exactly how that happens, we have to watch and see over the next, you know, 1 to 3 or 4 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Pacific Decadal Oscillation since 1854. And the PDO, for short, is basically an oceanic and atmospheric oscillation in the Pacific that fluctuates on the order of about every 25 to 35 years.
Brian Bledsoe is climate long-range forecast specialist with Weather 5280.
And you can see in the graph right there the blues and the reds. Well, the blues, that's when the Pacific is in a colder or negative state. And when you see the reds, that's what's in a warmer or more positive state. And the types of weather, not only short-term but long-term, that those changes provide are very linear to us here, whether it's in New Mexico or Texas or western Oklahoma, southwest Kansas, even up here in my backyard in the eastern Colorado, it's very applicable. So on the long view, that's what it looks like over the past, say, almost 170 years. Now, for the past 25 years, that's what it's looked like. And for those of you that may be scratching your heads, like, man, you know, it used to always rain from the late 70s through the 80s and even into the 90s. But boy, when we got into the 2000s, it really started to change. Well, that's because long about 1998, which is over here on the left side of the graph, the Pacific changed phase and it went to a negative or a cold state in the PDO. And you can see right there for the past quarter century, we have a lot more blue on that graph than there is red. And that's because that's the predominant phase that it's been in. And even over here on the right side of the graph, you could see that really for about the past 3 years, we've been solidly negative PDO. And in some cases, some of those indices have rivaled what we saw even back in the 1950s. So let's narrow it down a little more here for the past 3 years, okay? And you can clearly see that trend. But Something that's very interesting to me is what's gone on here recently. If you look over there on the far right side of the graph, you see that we were quite negative until January's reading came out. And we started to come back up toward not neutral territory just yet, just a lot less negative. We almost cut that negativity in half just by 1 month right there. And I think that is really important. So while La Nina and El Nino get all the publicity, it's like, man, we need this La Nina to get out of here. It's not about just the La Nina. And I've been saying this for a long time, that the PDO governs a lot of things that we see here in terms of longer range weather, aside from just La Nina and El Nino. So if that PDO is in a negative or a cold state, we struggle a lot of the time regardless if we are in an El Nino or a La Nina episode. In fact, the precipitation anomalies for the past 25 years, from January through December, and I've looked back through 25 years of this, okay, wherever you're seeing the yellows and the reds and the oranges, that's where it's been drier than average for the past 25 years. So we should be drier than average with this particular state. California's had problems. Oregon's had difficulty. And right up the center part of the country, from southeast Texas all the way into southern South Dakota, when that PDO is negative, we struggle with dryness. In fact, the only wetter than average places have been over there in the eastern Corn Belt and on up into the northeast for the past 25 years that we've been dealing with that. So if you look at where we've been the past year with these precipitation anomalies, okay, get a good visual of that right there. I'm going to go back one graphic right there. All of that red, brown, white, whatever, is precipitation anomalies that are drier than average. All right. So again, for the past year, it should have been dry in those places per history. And I use a lot of history for this kind of stuff because it's an excellent teacher.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
These are some significant declines in total cattle slaughter we're going to see as we go into 2025. We're looking at about a 4 million head reduction.
Randy Block is president and CEO of Cattle Facts at the recent Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar.
We'll get into 25, 26 is when we're expecting to see more of this new shackle space come online, aren't we? Well, obviously, that's not going to be the most ideal timing for some of that capacity to come online. Again, we're going to be in some pretty tight supplies. We're really needing to have our eyes open in here that we're well capitalized with those new plants as we work through here. Because the reality is these things are going to coincide in here pretty closely. Now, Kevin talked about the beef on dairy crosses. And obviously, that's going to fill some of that void. It's going to be an important component to our production systems going forward. But I think one of the other things that I want to bring to your attention is the reality of what has actually taken place as we've come through this last decade. I think sometimes we all forget how hard we had to run these harvest plants. How hard are the packers in the room had to run these packing plants on Saturdays for years? Look at these numbers. From the lows in slaughter in 2015, as we moved up in here to 2017, 18, 19, 20, 21, and again in 2022, we have harvested 35,000 to 50,000 head of cattle on Saturdays all those years. That's 1.75 to 2.5 million head of cattle harvested on Saturdays. Now, I ask you all in the room, if you had to vote today and guess, make a guess, how do you really expect that we'll be able to keep these plants running on Saturday? Do we have the labor force that really wants to work on Saturdays? I don't think so. So I think part of what we're going to go through in here as we look at the long-term industry, these plants in reality, we aren't going to have the cattle to run them on Saturdays, but I think running this many cattle through our plants on Saturday is probably in our rearview window now. I don't think we'll do that when we look at our industry going forward just because of the change in our labor force. So do keep that in mind. Again, I think sometimes we forget just how many cattle we had to work through our systems as we came through. Another major conversation point we've had through our industry is obviously price discovery, how we're merchandising cattle. And I think you all need to see where we've been. Obviously, we've sold a lot of cattle on formulas over the course of the last several years. And when you think about Kevin's comments on the record spreads that we've seen for Prime Choice, Choice Select, it makes sense why we're doing that, doesn't it? But I want you to look at the bottom part of the chart and look at the negotiated grid. That's really been a revived element in our marketplace. We've seen a significant increase in the number of cattle that have been merchandised on negotiated grid. You can see it a little bit better on this chart. Look at the yellow portion of this chart. Obviously, another million head a year that we've seen that have moved through that component of the market. Again, why are we seeing more of those cattle that are being sold on negotiated grids versus in the cash market? Again, they're a negotiated part of a weekly trade in here, but they're not selling on the flat cash market. It's because of these spreads.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We manage the National Beef Checkoff Program, so every time an animal is sold within the country, a dollar is collected. Half will stay in that state where it's collected, and then the other half comes up to national for, you know, national programming, marketing, research, promotion, things like that.
That's Greg Haynes. He's CEO of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, explaining what the CBB does.
So we manage that whole portion that's collected and comes up to us. We work with 9 contracting organizations that then implement the programs for us. So we really contract out with them and review what they're doing and make sure they're doing everything that they're supposed to do, because the checkoff program, beef checkoff program, is actually made in law. So it was part of the Farm Bill in 86. I think a lot of people don't realize that. So it's very prescriptive on what we can and can't do. And so we have to make sure that we're doing everything that the law says. And, you know, again, marketing, promotion, research, we can't do any kind of lobbying or, you know, disparaging other products or anything like that. We do have USDA overseeing us, so that's big. They make sure that what we're saying and doing is accurate as well. So there's a lot of checks and balances on this program to make sure those dollars are spent correctly.
Such a large budget, it's easy to overspend and underdeliver. So how does the CBB monitor those investments?
So our fiscal year starts at the beginning of October. So we've just finished our first quarter, but this meeting is very important for us because, like I said, these contractors are coming out here and they're giving updates to all our producers about these programs that are checkoff funded. So our board, we have 101 board members. Every one of these board members is on a program committee. There are 6 committees. So there's CBB members, also Federation members. So each of these committees has about 80 or about 40 people actually on them, you know, producers that are looking at this. So the contractors are giving those producers updates and talking about, you know, where the programs are going. But this is the opportunity for the producers to also give that feedback to the contractors. As they hear this, they can talk about what they like, or have you guys thought about this, or what about this? And so that helps kind of direct the contractors where they need to go and kind of enhance and continue to move these programs. So this is a super important meeting for that. There's another meeting we'll have in the summer, very similar, and that's where the contractors will bring kind of their final proposals for 2024. But again, all the producers on these committees are giving that feedback. So it's an important process to ensure, you know, the producers are engaged, involved in this. Our board, like I said, 101 people are from all over the country. So the feedback they're getting is very broad and very representative of the industry. So I think that helps really ensure that the programs are doing what they're supposed to do and meeting the demands of the producers.
So almost every cattle producer in the U.S. is investing. How can they learn more? Haynes explains.
There's 2 ways. You can go to drivingdemandforbeef.com. So it's kind of a long word, drivingdemandforbeef.com. You can get all the information there. You can also go to beefboard.org. And there you can get all this information. You can see the evaluation reports. You can see all the programs that are being funded. Our financials are on there. You find out about who are board members. Everything's on there. So again, we want to be very transparent. We want every producer who's paying into this to feel comfortable and trust that, you know, we're doing our best to get the biggest impact out of it.
That's Greg Haynes. He's CEO of the Cattlemen's Beef Board. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
At a Senate Ag Committee hearing Thursday, one common theme from lawmakers.
Can't stress enough how important crop insurance, Title I funding is.
A vital risk management tool.
And it's critical that we maintain that safety net.
It should be a top priority of this Congress to protect crop insurance.
You've heard it from everyone, I think, here today.
Yes, we did, and for sure.
We are seeing a great deal of interest in all of the policies that we stand up.
Marcia Bunger runs the USDA's Risk Management Agency. She told the hearing that back in the year 2000, that agency had oversight over 300 different crop insurance policies.
And now today we are at 600 policies.
Covering a lot of liability.
The dollar amount back in 2000 was $30 billion. Today we are at over $200 billion worth of liability.
And growing. Bunger says the industry is developing new policies to cover more crops and ramping up efforts to educate producers about those policies. Gary Crawford, Washington.